Living in cities has its share of pleasures and delights, and then there are a few drawbacks as well. Crowds and noise and bedbugs and rats. Let's focus on the bedbugs and rats. They exist in lots of places, but they've shown a particular skill in surviving and thriving in urban environments, and in many ways are products of those environments. I mean, think about it. Cities can produce evolutionary pressures just like any other ecosystem. And a pair of Canadian researchers tracked the pressures on a broad scale in a recent paper in the journal Science. It's called Evolution of Life in Urban Environments. It's the work of Mark Johnson and Jason Munshie South, who are both at the University of Toronto, Mississauga. We have Mark Johnson with us, Associate Professor of Biology and Director of the Center for Urban Environments. Mark, thanks for joining us today.
Good morning, Jeffrey. It's nice to join you and your listeners.
I love the name of the center itself, the Center for Urban Environment. So this is an ongoing field of study for you. This is not just a one-off thing.
That's right, and it's a rapidly growing area. And just as a point of clarification, Jason, my co-author, is actually at Fordham University in New York.
Oh, okay, great. Thanks for that correction. Appreciate it. He's at Fordham. You're at UT Mississauga.
That's right.
So, what made for you the interest in studying? I mean, biology is great, but then biology in an urban environment is sounds like it's not something done that much.
Well, to be honest, I actually don't like cities that much.
Oh,
I've been trying to get out of cities most of my life. I just like nature, and I consider myself a naturalist. But being in one of North America's largest cities now, Toronto and Mississauga, and having a young family, I just can't travel as much, and so. Being stuck in the city, I started to realize, wow, there's actually pretty fascinating biology around us, and we really don't understand how our behavior and the structures we create through cities is influencing the ecology, but especially the evolution of this life, and I really wanted to understand that, as did Jason as well.
Well, it seems like people would have figured out a long time ago. I mean, we've had cities for millennia now that we would have figured out that when you have lots of extensive built environments, it's going to force some changes to the landscape and to the creatures that live in it. But I guess we didn't think in terms of that actually meaning evolutionary pressures.
Yeah, you would have thought that because we are dramatically changing the environment, and that's one of the pressures that can lead to rapid evolutionary change within populations. But I think most evolutionary biologists are like myself in that, you know, they want to get out of the city and try and understand the evolution in a natural context. So going to the Galapagos Islands or to remote mountains and backwoods, not studying it in your own backyard. But it turns out that this may be where some of the fastest evolution is happening all around us in these cities.
Fastest, really? I mean, the pressure is that great that the creatures have to really adapt or die, essentially?
Well, there can be a number of responses. First, just to clarify, by evolution, I'm referring to a genetic change within a population through time. And in some cases, those genetic changes lead to changes in the traits, heritable changes in those traits within a population through time. And you can detect evolution in as little as two generations from the parent to the offspring. Now, in an urban context, in most natural contexts, we often don't know what's happening for a few generations, so we can see large enough changes. But within urban environments, we've seen evidence that cities and urbanization can influence the mutation rates of organisms, can influence their ability to disperse across the landscape, which influences their ability to carry genes from one population to another. Can lead to stochastic changes, so random fluctuations in genes, especially as populations get really small, and, as you were mentioning at the outset, can influence their ability to adapt novel adaptations in response to these changes associated with urban environments, cities.
Mark Johnson is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, Associate Professor of Biology at the University of Toronto, Mississauga. He's the Director of the Center for Urban Environments. He and Jason Munshie South at Fordham University are the authors of a recent paper in Science called Evolution of Life in Urban Environments that really lays out a lot of information about how those environments do change the creatures that dwell there. We haven't talked about humans yet. We'll get to that. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. And Mark, you used data from lots of other works. Tell us about what you did here.
Yes, so in our paper, we tried to provide a synthesis of every study that has tested whether cities and urbanization more generally can influence evolution within populations. And so in total, we looked at 192 different studies, including some of our own work, but also work by many other people throughout the world, from 134 species. And in doing this synthesis, we found that very frequently, urbanization influences the evolution of organisms as diverse as viruses, bacteria, insects, snails, mammals, and birds. It seems to be really influencing everything that's around us.
Is there a poster child? Is there one creature that best represents the kinds of changes that can happen in an urban environment?
I think there are a lot of poster childs. One of the organisms that's been best studied, though, would be mosquitoes, in that we frequently find that they are evolving in response to the urban environments that we're creating. Sometimes they're evolving in ways that allow them to adapt to the management strategies that we're trying to use to control them, because mosquitoes are one of the most important vectors for many human diseases. So they can adapt in some cases to the insecticides that we use to control them. But a very fascinating case of their adaptation is happening in London, England, and in a number of places around the United States, in which there's a particular form of a mosquito that's very common called the northern house mosquito. And typically the northern house mosquito, which is the scientific name is Culex pipiens, lives above ground. It feeds on birds and sometimes on mammals and needs that blood in order to produce its eggs. Well, what they discovered was that there's this form in London, England, that lives underground in the subways. And underground, it will eat, feed on humans when people go down there. In fact, it was a big problem during World War II, during the bombing raids, when people would go down there for shelter. They'd be ravaged by this mosquito. And it was given a new scientific name, the underground form, Culex pipiens molestus. Now, what they've discovered...
Because of molested people?
Exactly. Wow. Exactly. That's where they got the name. And so what they discovered through subsequent research is that those populations living below ground are genetically very different from the ones that are living above ground, even though there's only a few meters difference in distance between those populations. Moreover, the ones that are below ground, they no longer require a blood meal to produce their eggs. They don't go through a winter dormancy period, which the typical populations do above ground. And if you put them in a cage to mate, they don't even recognize one another as the same species. So not only have they adapted to these below-ground environments, but they seem to maybe on the road to becoming a new species. Now we see this same molestus form in New York City, Chicago, and places in California where some of your listeners are. And so this is a case where cities have driven rapid evolution, maybe the beginning of a new species living around us.
I'm curious about the part where they don't need a blood meal. I mean, is there something else they've substituted in their diets for this?
Isn't that amazing? Yeah, it's remarkable and requires further study. It hasn't been studied enough. There's been a small number of studies that have focused in on it, and they've shown that it can produce eggs without a blood meal, but what the alternative sources of food are, I don't know, and I don't think it's been studied.
Wow, so Culex pipiens and Culex pipiens molestus, just right. Basically up above ground and below ground.
And if I can just point out another poster child,
sure.
This is by a PhD student at University of Massachusetts, Boston. This is Kristen Winchell. She was studying the crested anole lizard, or anolis lizard, in Puerto Rico. And what she found was that this lizard typically lives in the forests, but in three cities, it's also very common in those cities. And so she did a study to compare the morphology and behavior of those lizards that were in the city versus the natural environment. And what she discovered was that those lizards that are in the cities have evolved to have longer limbs and stickier toe pads that allow them to better attach to the smoother surfaces created by buildings. And so here's an example of where a lizard that's living around people has adapted to the structures that we've created.
Wow.
Pretty amazing.
And over what period of time, Mark?
In a period of time, we're talking about decades to hundreds of years. So some of those, the oldest cities in Puerto Rico are hundreds of years, where it's not clear when that adaptation started, but it has been going on for a while at least.
We're talking about evolutionary pressures in cities. Mark Johnson and Jason Munchie South are the authors of a paper in Science on the November 3rd issue called Evolution of Life in Urban Environments. And you're getting a taste for just how much urban environments provide evolutionary pressures to the creatures that dwell in them. You can join us on the exchange. Questions, comments, or maybe offer up a species that you think is very different based on your knowledge of living in cities. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Bed bugs, are these something else that have changed because of urban environments, Mark?
Yes, and this case is really quite remarkable in that when I was growing up, bed bugs were really not much of a problem. I remember having an entomology professor at the University of Guelph, a gentleman by the name of Professor Steve Marshall. And he's one of the world's top field entomologists. And at that point, he had never seen a bed bug. Well, it's hard not to find bed bugs now. They are very common in many places around the world. And what we've discovered is the reason they're so common is because many bed bug populations have evolved a novel adaptation as a result of a new mutation that has arisen that allows them to detoxify the most commonly used insecticides used to control them. So typically the management strategy for these bed bugs is to use pyrethroid insecticides. Well, they have, which is very effective at killing them in the short term, but this mutation allows them to detoxify those pyrethroid insecticides. So you can spray, but they still persist. And the individuals that have that mutation then spread more of those copies to their offspring, and they've been able to pop up in many places, including on a recent flight from London to Calgary on a British Airways flight. It was all in the seats there. And so, yes, here's a case where our own management strategies has resulted in the evolution of adaptations to allow them to persist in our environments.
And I understand once you get a bed bug infestation, it's very hard to get out now for just these reasons you're talking about, that they've become resistant to some of the insecticides used on them.
That's exactly right.
Let's talk about some of the other creatures that people really associate with cities: rats and pigeons and cockroaches, for example. Let's start with the rats. I mean, they would have been there. They're there in the country too, as well. But I mean, are there certain ways in which city environments have caused them to change too?
Right. So, rats and a number of the other organisms you mentioned are what we often refer to as human commensals. These are organisms that rely on humans to persist in their environment. In fact, it's very, very hard to find them in a natural setting any longer. And so they have been living with humans for thousands of years. And so there was likely initial adaptations that allowed them to persist with and exploit human environments. Some of them live around us. Some of them even live on us, such as pubic lice, or even in us, such as the parasites that live within us. As they traveled around us and as our cities started to grow and industrialization led to larger cities and denser populations, we've seen continued and new bouts of evolution in these organisms. So in the case of the rats that you mentioned, my colleague Jason Munchie South at Fordham University, he specifically focuses in on these rats. And he is looking at them in a number of different respects. First of all, trying to understand, okay, if you're going to control these rat populations, how large of an area do you have to try and control? Are they typically restricted to one building so that if you control them in that one building, you've effectively wiped out the population? Or are they moving across the landscape over a much larger scale, which ends up being the case? They are moving over a much larger scale. So if you want to effectively control them, you have to work at that scale with your management strategy. The other thing that's been discovered is the most commonly used pesticides used to control rats, warfarin. Many populations have evolved adaptations that allow them to detoxify and be resilient to those pesticides. So here's another case, like the bedbug case, where the management strategy of using these pesticides has resulted in very strong evolution by natural selection. That was the mechanism that Darwin came up with to drive adaptations that allow them to persist in our environment.
Wow. So they do get more resistant over time to the things that we try to use against them. The pigeons, though, I had heard once when I was a kid and hanging out with my father in New York City that there were no dark-colored pigeons before there were cities and soot.
Right. Well, there's a lot of variation in pigeon coloration, and that is genetically based. I have never heard that it's related to soot coloration. So often a lot of these colors originate because of mutations that were selected by pigeon fanciers, individuals that would raise and breed these pigeons and like different colors and different plumages. But many of those got released back into wild populations and started breeding with residential naturalized populations, moving in some of these different colors. But here again, there is examples of evolution in response to urbanization, or at least evolution happening in our urban environments. The reintroduction of peregrine falcons in Los Angeles, for example, has led to peregrine falcons nesting on the buildings there, and they seem to be imposing natural selection on certain colors over others. So the original color with the black or the bluish tinged back and the white rump is harder for those peregrine falcons to catch than the white ones, the brown ones, and the ones with the solid, slate color rump. And so here's another example of where, you know, what's happening in the cities is still evolving, in part in response to the city environment we've created.
Thank you for letting the pigeon story down easy, but the falcon thing is really interesting, too. Mark Johnson is our guest on The Exchange. We're talking about evolutionary pressures from cities. He's an associate professor of biology at the University of Toronto, Mississauga, and director of the Center for Urban Environments there. He is the co-author with Jason Munshie South at Fordham University of a paper about these evolutionary pressures in cities. A couple minutes left with Mark. You can join us on The Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Boy, back in New York City in the 70s, the cockroaches seemed to be the bane of everybody's existence. Are these just highly adaptable creatures no matter where they are, or are cities providing some very specific pressures there too?
Well, German cockroaches specifically, you don't find them outside of human habitations typically. And so, you know, they'll be on farms in some rural areas, but they thrive in and around humans. And so they have initial adaptations originating from Southeast Asia, and then they have just followed humans around the world, evolving, again, novel adaptations that allow them to exploit our environments, and, again, adapting to some of the pesticides that we've thrown at them. This is a repeated phenomenon that as we try and control organisms, pests, what we view as pest species, with really potent insecticides, it works in the short term, but in the long term, typically leads to the evolution of resistance in these organisms we're trying to control.
I'm surprised, too, or at least interested in some of the further details inside the paper. Like the fact is that you can, obviously, in urban environments, get very isolated populations. So you can have different populations of mice in different parks in the city. They're essentially the same species, or were anyway, but they're getting very different over time.
Right. This is one of the most common phenomena that occurs. So that whenever a city is built, it leads to a fragmentation of the natural habitat. So as we're creating roads and buildings, the natural habitats of rivers and forests and fields becomes fragmented across that landscape. And a number of organisms become isolated in those little patches of remaining natural habitat. And it becomes harder for them to move across the landscape. And so what we see with this fragmentation of the natural habitat for native species especially, so those species that were there before the city, they start to become genetically different from one another. And so you can see this in populations even such as bobcats that are living around Los Angeles. The highways there have acted, and the city developments, as a barrier to the movement of these organisms across the landscape. Bobcats usually move a large distance, but we see that now some of the genetic differences between them are related to where the major highways are, where the major developments have been. We even see up in Fairbanks, Alaska, organisms as large as moose, which move very long distances, are not moving across the major highway that's going into Fairbanks, Alaska. Also, as I understand it, has a fence along it, and we're starting to see those populations on either side of that highway genetically diverging from one another. These genetic differences, because of this fragmentation caused by urbanization, grow through time. So, for example, in Montreal, Canada, they've looked at redback salamanders within the oldest parts of the city, which are over 300 years old, and they find that even two populations that are very, very close to one another, just a few hundred feet from one another, have genetically diverged over that time so that they're quite different. They're not different species, but you can see differences in their genes across those populations. If you go outside of the city and look at two populations that are separated by many, many miles, they're actually not that different from one another. And so this is an effect of how the city, through time, has fragmented the landscape and prevented these individuals from moving from one population to the next. And as a consequence, they've started to diverge from one another.
So do you and Jason come up with any observations or recommendations that might help urban planners to think more deliberately about how to accommodate desired creatures in urban environments?
Absolutely. So the first thing is our paper is just the tip of the iceberg. We really do not have a very good understanding of how urbanization is influencing evolution. What our paper shows is that this is happening, and it's very, very common, but the specific details we don't really understand. And so that's the first message, is we really need to understand this a lot more. The second message is that this may actually be really important to the conservation of native species, many of which have beneficial effects in our ecosystems, such as pollinators or plants that provide services for pollinators. And in order to maintain these populations, they need to be able to adapt to the changes in the environment. And when you have an isolated population that's relatively small, it can actually make it difficult for them to adapt to that environment. And so one way in which we can facilitate not only the ecology but the evolution of these species is by creating natural habitat corridors in which these organisms can move across that urban landscape.
So lanes, then, for the wildlife, sort of similar to the way we let people move from place to place on the city streets. Lots of interesting stuff in here. It's called Evolution of Life in Urban Environments, published in Science in the November 3rd issue by Mark Johnson and Jason Munshie-South. Mark Johnson's been our guest. He is the director of the Center for Urban Environments at the University of Toronto, Mississauga, where he's an associate professor of biology. Mark, thanks so much for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Have a great day.
All right, take care.